Pleasure to be back with you all again this warm afternoon. I want to look back at the psalm that we read for spend a few minutes thinking on it. Psalm 121, it's there in the bulletins. It's one of my favorite texts in the whole of Holy Scripture, though to be fair, there's a lot of texts that fit that category, so maybe that's not saying too much. But it's one whose basic message is kind of blindingly obvious. It doesn't trade on subtlety as a psalm. But there's one key aspect of it I want to look at a little bit that might not be clear on first glance. The psalm, it's not obvious there in the bulletins, but if you pull it open in your Bible, it's given to us with the title A Psalm of Ascents. When these titles were given to the psalms isn't entirely clear, and exactly what it means isn't entirely clear either. The best guess that we have is that it has something to do with the feasts of Israel. Some of you may have been here a couple of weeks ago at Pentecost when we spoke a little bit about the nature of the feasts. And the most relevant point here is the feasts were times for pilgrims. People would take pilgrimages to, eventually, Jerusalem, to the tabernacle where it was, and then, of course, the tabernacle being set up as the temple in Jerusalem. And everybody would go. From the very beginning, the feasts were times of pilgrimages. You go through the land and you walk down, usually south. Jerusalem's relatively south, and go to worship. It was a long journey for many people, short for others. But the songs of ascent, like this one and the others around them, are often taken as meant for use while you made your way to Jerusalem, to the temple, for these feasts. You ascended to the mountain. The temple was built on the mountain, Mount Zion. You ascended to the mountain where the temple was built, and so they're psalms of ascent. Makes sense, right? So I want you to think about going on a journey of this sort for a few minutes. It would be hot, so that part's easy enough to imagine at the moment. And you'd be walking with other pilgrims, and you need to think about what you would see on that journey, I think, to understand some of what the psalm is after. The roads of Israel were, in one particular way, a testimony of her unfaithfulness to the Lord. And you wouldn't have to walk very long on the road to see it. I don't mean something like a fear of thieves on the road, though that was obvious and important. Pilgrims going to a feast had money with them. Of course they did. There was no standing police force, no standing army, and the roads were terribly dangerous until Rome came, actually. I mean, what do you think you would see on the hills as you walked on that journey? Maybe you've done that brave, maybe foolhardy work of reading through your Old Testament. It's not for the faint of heart, I suppose, but if you've done so, you may remember coming across these phrases, the high places, over and over again. People go to the high places to worship or to bring a sacrifice and so on. Bad kings set up the high places. Good kings tear down the high places. And maybe you've read it and wondered what they were. Well, at the risk of flooring you all with my great insights, high places were locations with a higher altitude than the ones around them. Is that pretty good? They were high places. That's what they were. They were the hills that you would see. It's not a terribly hilly land, but it's not Iowa either in ancient Israel. And you would go and you would erect altars and pillars on the top of these high places. They're the place of strength, of honor. The temple itself, remember, is built on the high place in Jerusalem. It's where you would go to seat honor. And so that's where you would set up an altar to the gods, the fertility gods especially, the ones who would bring rain and make the crops flourish, bring protection. Well, listen again then to the opening line of the psalm. I lift my eyes to the hills. From where does my help come? The psalm begins in the reality of ancient Israel strewn with false gods, altars and pillars. It's the language of a polemic. Lovely as the psalm is, it starts with a polemic, a statement being made against other gods and the worlds around. The pilgrim walking to Jerusalem would look around and see at least remnants of pillars and altars on the high places up on the hills. It's what you would expect. And so walks to Jerusalem for worship with this psalm given to be on their lips. When I see these high places, my help comes from Yahweh, from the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Whatever the other gods might promise, the fertility, the rain, the crops, the safety, the Lord is the one who made heaven and earth, and so controls all of it. There isn't a sphere that falls outside of his rule. Whatever promises they might utter on the high places, I look to the Lord to guard. This language of the Lord is your keeper, the Lord is your guard, it's the same term. The psalm remains after that point in the very intensely personal sphere. It's not just some generalized, oh, the Lord is the help for various people somewhere. The Lord is your keeper, the shade at your right hand. He will not let your foot be moved. Whether you're awake or asleep, the dangers of the day, the dangers of the night, whether you go out, whether you come back, whatever it is, you have one watching over you. And that is all said in the context of this polemic. There's been a rash of writing recently on the idea of formative practices. It comes from a Notre Dame philosopher named Alistair McIntyre. He talks about our lives being filled with all kinds of formative practices, practices that form us and shape us and mold us, whether we want them to or not, has nothing to do with it. So when you get home from work, what's the first thing you do? Plop on the couch, turn on the TV, kiss your wife and kids, dozens of different things you might do. These are formative practices that we do, that we have. What do you do at work? The rituals, the habits of a workplace, a mall. There's a whole litany that goes along with a mall. Have you ever noticed this? The rubrics, what you expect, what you say, what they ask, what you respond. These are all pretty much set practices, and they're formative practices. James Smith, another writer writing in this vein, talks about the importance of the imagination in this context. It's how most sales work. If any of you are in sales, you know this. It's not rocket science. Whether you're selling ideas or cars or clothes or a future, you engage the imagination with ideas of the good life, what the good life really is. Get them thinking this way and then put your product into that setting. It's easy enough. A car commercial evokes strength, sexiness, reliability, open roads, and freedom. You don't evoke the image of trying to get through Minneapolis and St. Paul during construction season. No one thinks of that as the good life. So you have open roads, driving freely, safely. It's always a quiet car. News agencies prey on the same idea, but often do it on the exact reverse, if you've ever noticed this. People love to be afraid. It's bizarre, I know, but people do. And it's actually the same kind of thing. Your hope of the good life being under attack gets clicks. And so you clickbait with these sensationalist headlines, playing on the same idea. Paint a picture of the good life. In one way or another, what we all imagine to be the good life. Peace, calm, quiet, family, food, fill it in. Imagine a good life, and then you put your product in there as a way to enjoy it, to get there, whatever it might be, or the reverse, some idea, some person, some political figure is attacking that good life. This way of thinking, this approach to the world isn't at all new, even if the language we're using to talk about it is fairly recent. The high places represented that culture's ways of trying to find the good life. That's what they did. That's how they functioned. The good life was one where your crops actually came out of the ground. That was at least a start to it. I will help you there. I can send the rain. I can help your crops. I can protect your family. I will help you get the good life. And look, we all need and know the need for help with regard to the good life. It's not just some primitive idea that we've outgrown in our modern times or something. We might not always be very good at seeing someone's or even our own actions as cries for help toward the good life or something. But we all hear the same whispers and promises, I will help you there. I can be the way you get there. And we all know what it's like to be drawn to our equivalents of high places. You see what the psalm assumes, right, in the very first line? It assumes that the people of God, too, need help and will be looking around for help. That's where it starts. It doesn't start by arguing, you know, one day you might come across the need for help. It says it right away. You are there. The question is where you look to find it. If the high places weren't there and had no appeal, no hold on the imaginations, we wouldn't need a psalm like this one. It assumes that we hear what those high places are saying and the promises. They're whispers or shouts sometimes. A few years ago, my wife and I had a couple of children staying with us whose mother was in a bit of a crisis. They were twin 8-year-olds, a boy and a girl. Stayed with us for a while, and it was not easy. My wife's sitting there thinking that's a big understatement. The boy especially was quite difficult. And by the end, we had a good relationship, he and I. It took a long time. There was no father in his home. His experience of what it means to be a man was so obviously sexualized and violent. And he was trying so desperately hard not to be a helpless, scared 8-year-old boy. He struggled in school. Is that a surprise? It would have been so easy to fixate on all the things that were immediately apparent and were real in his life. He was a bully. He was big for 8 years old, and he used that strength against others. His language was foul. His clothing was of a certain sort, crass jokes. And continuing on the same path, maybe that's all people are going to see. I hope not. If he ends up on the news one day, that's the only thing that people will care to see and report. One of the more poignant memories, moments with him, though, was when he and his sister were telling me, trying to boast, there's a lot of this, telling me about the movies that they like to watch at home, the horror films, the deep psychological horrors, the bloody, grotesque horrors, the things that would make me blush. I thought they were just overstating it, and then we went and we were with them at their home for a little while, and you could see these films right there. What are all of those kinds of things from this 8-year-old boy, except a little boy and a little girl desperate to survive and find a way to survive in this world? What else are all those things? They still wet the bed every night. I would too. By the end, he just wanted to sit in my lap and have me read to him. Who knows if he ever got to sit safely in someone's lap. Scary movies offer a lot of adrenaline. Even when you're 8 years old, it's a lot of adrenaline, and a lot of adrenaline really helps to numb a lot of things. A tough bullying stance keeps hopes of survival alive. If I can be stronger and show myself stronger, I won't let you in. Sometimes I think it's very easy to dismiss people who go to those high places simply as the domain of the vile, to imagine the wicked, a real category, as always and only just wicked. We can look down on them in disgust and know ourselves, I at least am not them. We're good at that in the church. Maybe you're new to the church, just coming back to the church, never been in a church. We know sometimes we're good at that. But an alcoholic drinks to escape hurt, not just to hurt others. To escape having to reckon with the world and life as it comes. One trapped in pornography or sex uses the adrenaline like the 8-year-old boy watching a movie, a horror film, like a gambler, numbing and escaping. A mother who can't get hold of her temper when she's treating her children. It's a release to let loose. G.K. Chesterton said, "Every man knocking on the door of a brothel is searching for God." Not sure that's true, but at the very least, what he really meant, they're searching for someone. Help. I lift my eyes. Where does my help come from? We are not immune to high places in our day. We have them all over the place. We see them too. Mike Shinoda, some of you might know that name and not want to admit it here, but in a song for Fort Minor, a rap group, puts it bluntly. Says he's no Christian, but it's like poker. You can play your best, but you got to know when to fold your cards and take a rest. And know when to hold your cards and hold your breath and hope that nobody else is stacking the deck, because I don't need to tell you that life isn't fair. It doesn't care. It arbitrarily cuts off your air. And like you, I want someone to say it's okay. But in the truest parts of our hearts, everybody's afraid. What is this but the point at which Psalm 121 begins? Takes that for granted, assumes that that's where we start. The Israelites didn't go to high places simply to disobey God or simply because they just wanted to make the wrong decisions all the time. It's strange to get people's views of sin and sinners sometimes as if the solution is just stop. Oh. Or as if it's always simply a matter of high-handed rebellion, refusal to leave the idolatrous places we go for help. There is a lot of that, and I've seen too much of it. But it's not always like that. I have no doubt that there were a lot of people who went to those high places because, frankly, they were afraid. In the deepest part, truest parts of our hearts. Have you ever thought about how terrifying it would be in a situation, a culture, society like that, to face a famine and to watch your family not have any food? We talk about economic downturns. That's nothing to this. We run to high places too. For all kinds of reasons, we dress it up differently. Our fears might look different. But the psalm addresses us in the exact same place that it addressed them. Something about the world as we know it demands that we find help. It begins with us needing help. It's true whether you're a Christian or not. I am helpless is the first step of AA. And it's not just AA. Left to myself, it's all of us. And the psalm assumes it. Of course it does. Christians are the ones, we are the ones, friends, who can stand up and say the first thing we can all agree on is that we need help and cry for help. I wish we could live like Odysseus's men as Christians. Some of you know the story, who filled their ears with wax so they wouldn't hear the siren's song. Because everyone who heard the song of the sirens was drawn to them and their ships crashed on the rocks. So they poured hot wax in their ears so they couldn't hear it. We can't live our lives that way. In some ways it would be nice, but an Israelite would see the high places there whether he wanted to or not, whether wanting to protect your children from seeing the high places or not. They're there. They existed all around, and the reason for the psalm is the people of God would see them and would be tempted to say, I can get help there. What makes a Christian is not that we have figured it out and don't have to start where the psalm starts, needing help. What makes us a Christian is not that we don't see the high places. If you're here wondering what Christians are all about, then at least know that we're not about that. Having figured it out, having wax in our ears and trying to say la, la, la as we run through life. Walking through your pilgrimage as a Christian is a long road, and sometimes a hard road. Sometimes it's a delight, sometimes it's not. What makes Christians Christians is getting up in the morning, whatever else has happened and whatever the day holds, and walking that pilgrimage saying just what the psalm starts. I lift my eyes to the hills. I see those things. My help comes from the Lord. Telling ourselves that, who made heaven and earth. The God who sent Jesus Christ to conquer sin and death promises himself to guard you, to keep you, even at rock bottom, even in delightful days. He will keep you. The hard thing is getting up a day at a time and saying that to ourselves like we believe it. The psalm carries promises to us. Just like the high places tried to offer, here's the psalm, standing as a polemic. And the scriptures are full of these promises, this one promise. If you've been here while I've been preaching at the other moments, I'm sure you haven't remembered, but there's something of a theme to all of these, and we'll see it again next week with Psalm 131. God is a God of comfort to his people in the strong sense. Our shepherd who cares for his sheep even to his own death. He carries his church as we proclaim the victory of Christ until he brings it to full fruition. Again and again and again. And there's a reason the scriptures have this promise, because we need to hear it again and again, framed in every context, hitting us from everywhere, using all kinds of metaphors, direct and indirect. I am yours. You are mine. The heart of what God says is his relationship to us. Here's one more place. Listen to this from Isaiah 41. The kind of day-at-a-time pilgrim language. For I, the Lord your God, hold your right hand. I say to you, fear not. I am the one who helps you. I love the tactile nature of that phrase. I grew up in a home longing for that kind of safety. Safe touch, as I've learned to call it. Desperate for my hand to feel safe in another. So a text like this has a kind of searing power for me. I hold your hand, and I say to you, do not fear. So take heart. Our God, who made heaven and earth, will keep your life. Waking and sleeping, the dangers of the day, the dangers of the night, from this time forth and forevermore. Amen.